when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Coming up on DTNS, striking ISP workers build their own ISP, why the chip shortage may last for 2 years, and do you need a right to disconnect? This is the Daily Tech News for Thursday, April 15th, 2021 in Los Angeles. I'm Tom Merritt.
And from Studio Redwood, I'm Sarah Lane.
From Austin, Texas, I'm Justin Robert Young.
I'm the show's producer, Roger James.
I almost said tax day, and then I remembered they delayed it. So, you know, it's the it's tax day traditional, not the actual tax day here in the United States. We were just talking about the wonders of home ownership and solenoids and compressors. If you'd like to hear that, get our expanded show, Good Day Internet. Become a member at patreon.com/DTNS. Let's start with a few tech things you should know.
DJI announced the Mavic Air 2S, a drone with a larger 1-inch sensor able to shoot 20 megapixel photos and capture video at 5.4K or 4K at 60 frames per second. The Mavic Air 2S starts at $999, $200 more than the outgoing Mavic Air 2.
Dell Technologies is going to spin off its 81% stake in VMware into an independent company. Zane Rowe will stay on as interim CEO. Michael Dell will be the chairman of VMware's board. Dell plans to use the proceeds of the spinoff, which are estimated to be between $9.3 and $9.7 billion, to pay down some debt.
A new U.S. executive order placed sanctions on Russian companies and individuals in response to interference in the 2020 presidential election and formally names Russia's Foreign Intelligence Service as the perpetrator of the SolarWinds Orion supply chain attack. As part of the order, the U.S. Treasury Department added six Russian technology companies that provided support to intelligence agencies to the U.S. entity list.
Oh, the entity list just keeps getting bigger. LG now lets U.S. customers inquire to buy its motorized 65-inch 4K rollable OLED RTV. Exact U.S. pricing is unknown. Basically, if you have to ask, you can't afford it. But the TV went on sale in South Korea in October for 100 million won. That gives you any idea. 100 million won is about $89,600.
Oh, it's a lot more affordable than I thought it would be. It would be great on my wall. Yeah, can't wait. Lyft launched Lyft Pass for healthcare, which, as the name implies, lets healthcare organizations and social service agencies create prepaid passes for Lyft rides to doctor's appointments. The orgs created a budget to provide pickup and drop-off locations, and then patients can apply it to their own ride. Now, Lyft already partnered with some healthcare organizations in the past to schedule trips for patients, but this lets the patient request the trip themselves within Lyft's app. A similar service from Uber, Uber Health, launched back in 2018.
All right, let's talk about those plucky strikers creating their own ISP, Justin.
Indeed, Tom. New York City Spectrum workers have been on strike for 4 years, and the 1,200 or so striking members of IBEW Local 3 have now created their own ISP called People's Choice Communications. The company operates on a fixed wireless service using a mesh network. A building that wants to sign up for service pays People's Choice to install the antenna on the top of the building to receive service and then run Ethernet cable and routers into apartments. Once it's installed, residents of the building own the building's network and enter into a co-op relationship with People's Choice, so profits are returned in part to customers. Installation fees right now are estimated at around $200 to $300 per apartment and paid off in monthly installments of $10 to $20, which also covers ongoing service, so pretty cheap. People's Choice main antenna is capable of providing service to most of the Bronx right now with 25 megabits per second down and 3 up. It has completed installations at 2 schools and connected 121 units at housing for survivors of domestic violence who have disabilities. As more customers sign up, bandwidth will get cheaper and People's Choice can offer higher speeds. One way to expand service faster would be to get on the city's bid to provide affordable wireless networks for underserved areas.
An unnamed Spectrum employee is telling me right now, with RF interference in New York City, that'll work like a fork for grits. So not the it's not easy, but these are 1,200 people who know how to build networks in New York City. So I'm going to bet they can figure out how to at least make this palatable, and they've got some installations going, but it's not easy. Any kind of ISP in New York City is not easy. It is an interesting roll your own situation. We've seen towns in Colorado and Idaho decide that it was better for them to just go their own way. Sometimes it was neighborhood associations, sometimes it was whole towns. This is New York City doing it. My guess, and I don't say this because I want it to fail, my guess is this probably won't catch on. This is going to have too much opposition from entrenched interests, and it's going to take the city cooperating to really give it the boost it needs, or a lot of buildings being convinced to do this. And those are both hard roads.
Well, yeah, because if you're a landlord or a superintendent, why deal with the hassle? Why lay out any money, even if it's fairly nominal compared to any kind of other infrastructure that's going to be there? That being said, I want to take a sentence. You said that running any ISP in New York is hard, and shorten that to running an ISP is hard.
Well, that's true.
That doesn't mean, though, that we shouldn't have them. I love micro ISPs. I think that the internet is getting to a very interesting commodity phase where, specifically in certain contexts, you can have somebody, a company that is more agile, that's serving a smaller portion of the population, and in high density cities like New York, that could be possible. I don't know if this is the particular solution. And I would also wonder, hey, let's say one day you resolve this strike, where does the focus of the People's Communication, the People's Choice Communication Network go? If this is not a startup, if it's kind of a side project, I don't know if I want to commit to it.
The pricing also, it looks great when you look at the, you know, installments, you know, 10 bucks, but yeah, that's installments going to take a while. You know, when something's $300 to $400 to install, I mean, that's, for anybody, that would be a hefty price, you know, to look at up front to get something like this. Also, and listen, underserved areas, any internet is better than no internet for sure. But, you know, this is not internet that I could use for something like the show. It's limited. And that's not even taking into account the complexities of a city like New York City. But I like this idea. And yeah, like you mentioned, Justin, having, you know, a landlord of a, you know, multi-unit building sign on to this, and instead of just kind of doing what everybody does already, that's a goal as well.
Well, and the thing is, like, sure, all the residents can put pressure on the landlord, maybe get him to do it. All the people in the co-op can put pressure on the board president and get her to do it. But each building is going to be its own fight, right? This is not an easy situation, right? So you've got to go building by building, or get that city contract that lets you build up the momentum where people go, oh, I'm getting 50 megabits per second now. This is great, and it's so much cheaper. There's just a lot of hurdles. Not that it's impossible. There's just a lot of hurdles.
I mean, yeah, by the way, shout out to anybody in the Bronx who's still waiting for their superintendent to fix that leak. And then you can go ahead and email us and let us know how likely it is that they're going to roll the dice on an experimental ISP.
Well, here's some good news, or at least more evidence that VR is becoming a fitness device. We talked about this on the show yesterday, and the timing is impeccable because Facebook has just added the ability for VR developers to sell subscriptions to apps within the Oculus Store. Fit XR, Trip with two P's, and VZ Fit are all fitness and wellness apps that are among the first apps to be able to do this. Virtual monitor app VSpatial, social app Rec Room, and DJ app Tribe XR are also starting in headset subscriptions. Gosh, these names. We really have to come up with better names. Anybody who downloaded or purchased these apps already will keep access to what they have now. So having a new subscription doesn't mean you have to buy an add-on that you already bought. So that's kind of nice. Supernatural, which is obviously a fitness app that I love, told The Verge it will also bring subscriptions into the Oculus store as well. Oculus will require every app to offer a free trial period, although the length varies per app. So it's not like 60 days across the board, but free trials are good. At first, I was like, well, I have a subscription to Supernatural. Didn't I already do this? But no, I didn't. Not within the Oculus store. It was something that I had to download the app on my phone, which is an app you want anyway. But that's where I had to pay for it and then get a code and then put my headset back on and then enter the code. And it was pretty cumbersome. It worked, but it was not something where I was able to, you know, do a little VR click and purchase a subscription within the app. So that's a nice, I don't know, erasing one barrier to entry, I guess, for folks and letting app developers experiment with stuff to keep retaining customers.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going through the check marks of things Facebook has to do to make Oculus profitable, offering in-app subscriptions that it can take a cut of is absolutely one of them. And developers want that too. Subscription revenue is recurring. You don't have to ask again. You just have to keep people from going through the trouble of canceling the subscription. In-app purchases only happen once. Certainly, you know, single purchases of apps only happen once. So this is important for the revenue streams of developers. It's important for the revenue stream of Facebook. And it shows that there's more than just gaming going on here, because like Sarah said, a bunch of the first apps to jump on this are fitness related apps. It furthers that narrative we've been talking about of, you know, VR becoming not solely for fitness, but certainly fitness becoming one of the main reasons people use it. So we're getting a few more of these reasons besides just gaming.
And not just VR, Oculus, because what Oculus has is a non-tethered solution, which means fitness is more of a reality. But I think that this goes far beyond that. I would love to know exactly what the cut is that Facebook is doing, whether or not they're trying to make it a little tastier for some developers to come on there. And it would not shock me, considering Facebook has a lead here with Oculus. They have a product that nobody else has been able to match, and it doesn't look like there's anything on the horizon, at least for the next year. If they want to develop an app store community here where they can build not Apple-esque, but certainly maybe a nascent version of that, then I also think things like Netflix, HBO Max, some of those entertainment options are a possibility here, and now they can be the ones that taste that sweet recurring subscription revenue each and every month.
Well, let's go from sweet subscription revenue to, oh my gosh, how are we ever going to sell chips when we can't make enough of them? As we've covered many times on DTNS, there's a worldwide chip shortage impacting automakers the most, but affecting a lot of industries. It was caused by mistaken estimates of when demand would fall and recover during the pandemic, complicated by winter weather in Texas, fires in Japan, a drought in Taiwan, and also companies building up inventory for fear of future shortages. A little bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy there, but also caused a little bit in China in response to U.S. trade restrictions. So we all know how we got here. How long is this gonna last? How long before we get back to a normal supply chain? Well, this week, multiple tech companies filed public financial disclosures, which included forecasts on chip production, and they're not rosy. Intel offered to step up supplies of chips for medical suppliers and in-car computers, which is good news for those industries, but CEO Pat Gelsinger told the Washington Post he expects the worldwide chip shortage to last a couple of years. Now, that was the worst, most pessimistic estimate, but the rest aren't that much better. TSMC CEO C.C. Wei told investors, quote, "In 2023, I hope we can offer more capacities to support our customers. At that time, we'll start to see the supply chain tightness release a little bit." Though TSMC did tell automakers that its chip supply could improve next quarter, as they're throwing a little more of their capacity at automotive, TSMC is running current fabs at more than 100% utilization. So without building more factories, they can't make any more chips. Thursday, the company said it hoped to offer more capacity in 2023. NVIDIA CFO Colette Krebs said, quote, "We expect demand to continue to exceed supply for much of this year." So she at least was holding out 2022 as a possibility for easing this for NVIDIA, but did say that the supply should steadily increase throughout the year. It just won't outstrip demand until 2022. It's interesting to see Intel and TSMC focus on extra capacity as the way out of the shortage, because up until now, most analysts that I've been reading have believed that current capacity might be enough once the hoarding ends and the logistics problems get resolved. So these companies are betting on, hey, you know what? Maybe this doesn't go away unless we're able to make more chips. Either that or Intel and TSMC are both saying, let's sign up a bunch more new customers while we can.
Yeah. You know, this is a fascinating, like you mentioned, a real perfect storm of a lot of different factors, a lot of things kind of not necessarily going wrong, just going at the same time that results in something that I think is going to be felt at the end point with the consumer, both in terms of availability and in terms of price, which will, of course, mean that aftermarket price is going to be bigger.
Yeah. P-Squared 1234 at our Discord says chips have become industry's toilet paper hoarding. And we've compared that.
It really does kind before. Of remind me of that, at least, you know, on large company scales. Let's keep some of these chips.
Yeah, we better buy more chips because we might run out of chips, which is causing chips to run out. And big consumer demand. Consumer demand mm-hmm. went up during the pandemic for laptops, cameras, you know, a lot of stuff. They sort of underestimated the demand for cars. So, yeah, all those things contribute to this. And I do still think, it just seems to me that demand will work itself out. And this will go back down. And so if you build up all that extra capacity, are you going to have too much capacity? Or are Intel and TSMC looking at this like, well, we want to throw extra capacity at this anyway because we have older plants that we want to retire, et cetera.
Yeah.
But then we talked about how the display chip shortage for automotive is based on older plants anyway. You can't really build new plants to add to that. So I don't know.
I mean, the worst problem would be consumer demand has plummeted. Nobody wants to buy our products, right? Like, I mean, that would be the real problem. This does seem like, yes, it's a little bit of a, you know, it's a guessing game. You got pandemic and then you have natural disasters, not one, but several that impacted this whole thing. That is not something that is normal. It's very unusual for all of that to happen in such a short amount of time. I mean, you always have to plan for emergencies, but it does seem like a lot of these companies are like, yeah, if we go too overboard, then we're going to have a surplus because consumer demand spiked and then it's going to ease back and, you know, dip as it does every few years anyway. And yeah, we don't want to be caught with, you know, warehouses full of chips that people don't want.
And if it's a supply chain issue, if it's just transportation, building more chips doesn't make it better. You just have more chips sitting in the port, you know?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. It's the size of the pipe. They got to figure out how to get it through.
Hey, folks, we're doing a crossover show this weekend with This Week in Science. I'm really excited about this. Saturday, April 17th, 7 p.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. Pacific. Myself, Sarah Lane, Roger Chang, along with Dr. Kiki, Blair, and Justin from TWiS. We have been taking your topics. Thanks for sending them. We're in the middle of figuring out what we're actually going to talk about, but you should come watch. The show happens this Saturday, April 17th, 7 p.m. Pacific. 7 p.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. Pacific, and you can watch live at dailytechnewsshow.com/live.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Stripe Tap to Pay on iPhone came along and changed everything. With Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. No more juggling different methods. Just a simple tap on my iPhone and transactions are complete. What's truly remarkable is how Stripe caters to all my customers' preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Stripe ensures a smooth checkout experience every time. Setting up Stripe was a breeze, taking just minutes to get up and running. From local markets to global retailers, Stripe helped me expand my reach and grow my business with ease. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone. This podcast is supported by Tools and Weapons, the podcast hosted by Microsoft Vice Chair and President Brad Smith. Right now on a special edition of Tools and Weapons, Brad Smith is sharing a vision for what Microsoft calls the new AI economy. It's an idea rooted in technological revolutions of the past, like the printing press, which created a vibrant marketplace of related innovations, ultimately leading to an explosion of books and readers. But he doesn't just give a history lesson. In the episode, Brad lays out the tangible ways that Microsoft is providing infrastructure and other support to those leading the charge of the new AI economy. And he explains the importance of using that infrastructure to ensure equitable access to AI to people all over the world. To stay current on insights from voices at the center of the conversation on AI, follow or subscribe to Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith wherever you like to listen.
The UK Union Prospect, which represents scientists, engineers, tech workers, is lobbying the government to create a right to disconnect. The law would stipulate when companies could communicate with workers,
it would
but
not
require,
stipulate. Sorry, not
it stipulate. Would not stipulate when companies could communicate with workers, but require that companies negotiate with staff on rules about when and when not you can be contacted for work purposes. A poll by Opinionum found cross-party support, with 65% of labor and 53% of conservative voters supporting this proposal. This month, Ireland introduced a code of practice on April 1st that says employees have the right not to be penalized if they don't work outside normal hours. Canada, meanwhile, is investigating a similar policy.
This is a problem. Does anybody disagree that there is a problem of people, you know, feeling like I have to work constantly, especially now that I work from home, there's no more lines. I have to work constantly. Agree on that?
It's hard for me to know it because I have the world's worst boss myself. So it is hard to draw lines, but I know for my wife, for example, like she's had to set alarms. Alarms are constantly going off in our house, not for things she has to do, but rather just it's time to eat lunch. It's time to stop working and turning on various different, alerts. So the rest of the company's Slack knows.
Yeah.
In the early 2000s, working at Tech TV, Tom, Roger, you were both there, and we had a mail system, Lotus Notes. And there was a way to VPN from your house if you weren't at work, but it was kind of early days of that stuff. And most of us just never set it up or didn't know how.
They wouldn't give it to everybody. I remember that. I had to plead to get it. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. It was not something that I had at home and not something I particularly wanted. And it was, for years, it was like you leave the office, your work is done because you can't work. There's nothing I could do from home unless I was like sketching notes on a notepad. Until I come back to work the next day. And as long as I'm getting there on time, I'm good to go. That is not the life that most people lead anymore. You are available 24/7, technically, through some device of sorts. And yeah, I think it's burying people, a lot of people.
So do we need a right to disconnect?
I think really what this is a framework for lawsuits. That if you are saying, okay, my employer said I'm going to sue them for wrongful termination. Well, they said that I wasn't productive. Well, I'm going to say, the law says I did everything that I possibly could within the hours that I could, and they were asking me to do things that were extra legal. In that respect, I think it's fine. What this really should do, and this is what bothered me about every job that I ever had with an actual boss, is that you need to set up definitions of what your workday is, as opposed to it just being a thing where if you clear your plate fast, then they're going to fill your plate with more stuff. Like that is a top level management problem that I think exists in business around the world. And the better we get at that, just give me what I need to do today. And when I do it, if it's done by 11 a.m., then I'll see you at the bar. I'm day drinking today. Like that should be the way it goes. Unfortunately, it's not. And it runs into problems like
yeah,
this.
Yeah. And not every job works that way. Right. So it becomes problematic in that respect. I think, you know, every single person in our audience is going to have a different position on how much the government should or should not be involved in whether they're fixing this problem. But I think we can agree it's a problem. And I like the idea, whether it's the government should do it or not, I like the idea of companies saying we need to have a policy and we need to stick to that policy so that everybody knows what the rules are. And you can't say, well, that person never answers their email at night and the rest of us do. That's unfair. Like, let's all agree on what the norm is. Well, here's a norm for you. Bookshelf speakers that look like books. Bang & Olufsen collaborated with London design agency Layer on its latest bookshelf speaker, the BioSound Emerge, and it is the most book-like bookshelf speaker yet in that it literally looks like a book. It has a knitted fabric spine that says Bang & Olufsen like it would on a book, then two oak covers, as well as containing some gold tone aluminum. It's a little narrower in the front than in the back, so it's almost like you've got it backwards and it's partially open. But if you want to save money, there's also a black anthracite version with an aluminum grill and a polymer side panel. Same form factor, doesn't look quite as much like a book. Controls on the top control play, pause, volume, and track changes, along with a couple of programmable buttons for things like playlists and radio stations. And like Bang & Olufsen's BioSound Level, the BioSound Emerge is future-proof. It has a replaceable connectivity component that B&O says should be software upgradable for several years, but when it does eventually get obsolete, you can swap it out for newer components that'll work and keep the look. You don't have to forfeit your book look if you want the latest new processor in the future. Inside the book-like speaker is a 37mm mid-range driver, a 14mm tweeter pointed out the front. There's a 100mm side-firing woofer that kind of points towards the back. It supports AirPlay 2 and Chromecast, Google Assistant for voice control, has an Ethernet port, and a line-in optical jack combo. Coming to Europe April 15th, elsewhere in the autumn. Priced at $899, or if you want to cheap out on the black anthracite version, only $699.
I love how the one that looks more like a speaker is $200 cheaper. Listen, I don't have the money for a $900 speaker that looks like a book. It's very pretty. You know, Bang & Olufsen makes high-end speakers. That's, you know, we already know that. It's a cool form factor. I would assume, you know, if you really wanted it to look like a book, to have it squished between a bunch of books is going to defeat some of the purpose, especially with the sub in the back. But it is lovely. And, you know, as sort of an art piece that also works as a speaker, nice and thin. I mean, if the sound quality is great and someone's got the money, it's very nice looking. But the black version, same form factor, but it definitely looks like, oh, that's a piece of electronic equipment. Certainly not a book.
It is fascinating to see kind of where the fashion has gone with stuff like this, that ostentatious, gigantic speaker stacks are kind of out. And now what we want is something that is as invisible as possible. We just sort of want great sound to permeate everything. We don't need to necessarily show off to our friends. Or at least I'm speaking with the royal us and the we buy $900 speaker club.
It's, you know, you're right, especially with all the smart assistants where you don't have to have, you know, we were talking about remotes the other day, right? It's like, put away the remote unless you really need it, right? You can kind of just talk to your TV and declutter the place. I used to have these huge Bowers & Wilkins speakers. They were like my pride and joy. I still miss them. I ended up moving somewhere where they just didn't fit anymore, but I wouldn't have them back now because I'm like, I just have like all these other small speakers that are perfectly fine for me and actually just kind of streamline the place.
Speakers also got better. And when they got better, they got smaller. And that also kind of, it's not just rich people wanting to look poorer for fashion, but rather like we have the ability to now.
Listen, if you're going to buy these Bang & Olufsen speakers, back us on Patreon.
Yes. first. Yeah. First, do the Patreon backing.
Yeah, just do it. An update to Google Earth will add a 3D time-lapse feature to see how maps have changed from 1984 through 2020. These time lapses use 24 million satellite images to create one 4.4 terapixel sized video mosaic, with users able to search for places of interest or view 5 guided tours based around specific topics.
Man, I remember Google Earth.
These are neat 3D images where, you know, instead of flat 2D. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Tom.
No. I was just going to say, I remember when Google Earth first came out and I downloaded it onto my IBM ThinkPad running Windows XP. And it was really cool. Here it is. First update since 2017. Did I read that right?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah,
great.
I really hope that they do a VR-centric rollout on this, because if you've never screwed around with Google Earth in VR, it's really, really fun. And that would be something really cool, to just watch the world slowly change in front of you and being able to zoom in.
It's kind of like...
I mean, it's cool, and it's also kind of depressing, depending on which part of the world you're looking at.
Sure, I guess so. And you don't really need to update Google Earth. Honestly, this is a counterpoint to everybody's like, oh, Google always just cancels stuff. Look at Google Earth, just sitting there, perking along.
Just sitting there, chilling out, being Earth.
Chugging away.
Spinning around. All right, let's check out the mailbag.
This one comes from Kome, also a big fan of the VR fitness app Supernatural. Kome and I have actually been talking about this since I got my Quest last year. Kome says it has the best implementation of immersive 360-degree scenes, real locations, not CG, with stereoscopic depth among many VR apps I've seen. They really pick the beautiful exotic locations that you don't usually see even in travel magazines. So I created this map listing, all the locations that we saw in Supernatural, hoping I could visit many of these spots in real life someday. We'll have the link in our show notes, but Kome, it's awesome, because within the app, for anybody who's, you know, not used it before, as a song starts, you kind of be like, we are now in Peru, and you look around and go, oh, this is so pretty. And it tells you where you are. But unless you look it up on a map, you might not know exactly where in the country or where in the world you really are. So it gives you a perspective of how many scenes are actually involved. It's awesome.
And then Nick wrote in and said, the news of the new AirLink feature for Quest 2, while not unwelcome, made me think they finally killed it. No, they didn't kill the Quest, but rather an app called Virtual Desktop for the Quest. Virtual Desktop is an independently developed app that has allowed Quest users to stream their PC VR games to the Quest for years now. Granted, the process for using Virtual Desktop never was the most user-friendly process. It required you to buy an app on the Quest, then put the Quest into developer mode, sideload a patch to enable desktop streaming due to Quest App Store rules, and while I look forward to an easier way to stream PC VR games to my Quest, I feel bad for the developer of Virtual Desktop. Yeah, Nick, man.
Virtual Desktop is a crowd favorite for sure.
Yeah, there was a great meme on the Oculus Reddit of the Virtual Desktop and Facebook, like, I made this, you made this, I made this. you know, thing. So that is a meme going around. But ultimately, it's like, this is suffering from success. They pioneered something that people loved, but it just wasn't, you know, spectacular technologically enough to beat back the tides of change.
Am I nostalgic for the Cydia App Store on a jailbroken iPhone? Sure. Would I replace the App Store with it? Probably not.
Yeah, that's going to happen. Right.
We all have the examples of like, I used to do this the old way. Remember when the OS didn't actually have this natively built in, and we all had to do it the old way. It happens. Well, if you have feedback or questions or comments, send them all of them, every single one, to feedback@dailytechnewsshow.com. We do love to get your feedback, so keep it coming. Also, shout out to patrons at our master and grandmaster levels, including Brad, Ken Hayes, and Tony Glass. Also, thank you to our brand new boss, Chase Ludwig, who just started backing us on Patreon. Thank you to our new boss.
Chase is our new favorite boss.
Yay, Chase. Today is your day. Have a cake.
Don't contact me after work, though.
You're right. It's too late, Chase. Thanks to Justin Robert Young, who will not like to be contacted after work or while he is playing VR mini golf.
Indeed. When I'm not playing mini golf, I am producing the Politics podcast. Got a great episode coming out tomorrow, featuring the one and only Andrew Heaton, who was on this show with me last week. But we go do a deep dive into the laws, the new voting laws in Georgia and the proposed laws in Texas. He did a ton of research on it, and I think it is a very illuminating conversation. You can find it at px3podcast.com.
Excellent. Well, we're live on this show Monday through Friday. It's only Thursday. You got one more day in this week, 4:30 p.m. Eastern, 20:30 UTC. You can find out more at dailytechnewsshow.com/live. And we will be back tomorrow with Lamar Wilson and Len Peralta. Talk to you then.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network. Get more at frogpants.com.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Stripe Tap to Pay on iPhone came along and changed everything. With Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. No more juggling different methods. Just a simple tap on my iPhone and transactions are complete. What's truly remarkable is how Stripe caters to all my customers' preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Stripe ensures a smooth checkout experience every time. Setting up Stripe was a breeze, taking just minutes to get up and running. From local markets to global retailers, Stripe helped me expand my reach and grow my business with ease. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.